A report by the Pew Charitable Trust, Fiscal 50, State Trends and Analysis, revealed that after the Great Recession officially ended in June 2009, the financial conditions of the states continued to improve. But a majority of those states are still struggling with lower tax revenues, employment rates, and reserve funds, along with the challenges of dealing with unfunded pension and retiree health care costs for public workers. Kai Wright, a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and a reporting fellow of the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, talks about what he discovered about the economic recovery after he spent 2 years visiting Albany, Georgia, where the poverty rate is 39.9%. His article in the August issue of Harper's is called "What Recovery? 2 years in a town where the Great Recession never ended." I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
When the Great Recession ended, what were some of the nation's poorest cities?
Well, I mean, a lot of them are your predictable ones, the Rust Belt towns that we often hear about, Reading and places like that. But I think what stood out for us with Albany was that while it had always been a place where you'd had poverty, right? You'd had poverty for some time, but they'd been one of these places that over the past 30 years had been scrapping and scraping and slowly building a better economy. And then at the time of the recession between 2007 and 2010, Albany became the city with the sharpest poverty rate in the country. So it had the worst recession in the country in that time.
And they wound up in third place. The others, Reading, Flint, and Bloomington, have struggled with high unemployment and poverty for decades.
For decades.
Now, but same kind of problem, isn't it? Industry left.
Well, I mean, so this is what we went down there to discover. I mean, I think the big idea here was that at the end of the recession, we had reached a point in our political culture where everybody kind of was familiar with this idea of income concentration, and that we reached a historic mark for wealth and income concentration in the country. But the corollary to that, which was much less discussed, is that we've also reached a historic mark in terms of the breadth and depth of poverty in our country. And so the point was to go to Albany and see what drove that, and it wasn't just the disappearance of industry. It was the culmination of decades worth of choices.
Albany, Georgia's a fairly small city, 76,000 inhabitants.
Yeah, it's small and getting smaller is part of the problem. But it's an important city in the sense that it was the anchor for the regional economy. So all over the country, we have these kinds of places where, you know, you have a bunch of rural counties with a city at the center that holds that whole regional economy together.
Wasn't it named after Albany, New York?
It was. When they founded the town, they had aspirations of being a trade center for the South, much in the way that Albany, New York, was a trade center for the North. And they did succeed at that as the railroads came and for generations, kind of slowly built some wealth.
And when all of those industries moved south, they probably benefited. In good times, there were jobs in Albany with Firestone, Miller Brewing, Procter & Gamble, Georgia Pacific, Bob's Candies, textile factories, which had moved from New England. When did the jobs start leaving?
Well, piece by piece. You mentioned Bob's Candies. It's one of the good examples. It was a company locally owned for generations. They went through the Depression. They went through natural disasters. One of the guys I profile in the article, somebody who at 18 moved from rural area outside of Albany to work at Bob's Candies, worked there for 25 years.
This is Major Jones.
Major Jones. Worked there for 25 years, worked up from, you know, $5 an hour to $19 an hour with no college degree, and had, most importantly, had job security. He had relationship with the ownership for better
health insurance.
Health insurance. And he knew he could work. He knew he could always work. And then they were amongst the folks who were pushed out by this Bob's Candies by two of the forces that come up a lot. One being free trade deals and the other being the private equity boom of the mid-2000s.
Is that why the McCormick family sold the country?
So they're kind of a perfect storm. So one, they had difficulty keeping up with the competition because of the two factors. One, people were able to move. NAFTA encouraged a lot of folks to move their jobs to Mexico in the candy industry. They didn't want to do that at first. But then also alongside that, you had the rise of big box retailers like Walmart. And in order to compete, you know, when you talk to the Bob McCormick, who was the last owner in the family, he says, you know, you'd wake up one morning and because you didn't lower your price by a penny, you've lost half your business. And so the pressures of keeping up with this sort of rapacious short-term profit of big box retailers and the and his competitors' ability to move across the border to get cheaper labor just drove them to the point where they could no longer stay open.
You're right that Bob's Candies was notable for hiring black workers who lived in the area. Was that part of the company's mission?
It wasn't. It was an accident. you know, but this is the kind of thing when you have a local economy as opposed to one driven by global forces, right? And so over the generations, they just happened to be one of the companies that hired black workers. They started hiring black workers back during segregation. And paying them
the same as the white workers.
Yeah, and they had a majority black workforce, and that led to people like Major saying, "Oh, that's a place I know a black person can get a job," and so he would move to Albany to get that job. You know, we don't want to over romanticize the past here, right? I mean, there were plenty of problems in those kinds of relationships, obviously. But I think what is important about the shift from in Albany from a place like Bob's Candies away from it is that you had a place where you had job security, and that is not something that Major now has.
And you're right that when Bob's Candies closed, it put 280 people out of work, but that was nothing compared to the closing of Cooper Tire and Rubber.
Yeah.
How many people lost their jobs when that plant closed?
It was thousands. I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but it was thousands, and it was the real death blow to Albany. And again, here we have a process where, you know, Cooper had set up there in 1992. I interviewed.
So fairly recently.
They came in 1992 to great fanfare. It was again coming out of some difficult times nationally. We were coming out of a recession right about then, and they came to town and people were very excited. And one of the guys I interviewed, who Chuck Jensen, I'm forgetting Chuck's last name, but Chuck Jensen.
Chuck Jenkins.
Chuck Jenkins. Apologies. He went to work there, was one of the very first people to hire, worked there for 25 years. And, you know, his story represents a lot of what has happened for workers like him, right? So he had security. He had a great job. He made, you know, $50,000+ a year. Cooper Tire comes along, the World Trade Organization comes along and lets in Chinese tires to the United States market, right? That leads to a lot of pressures on pricing here, but what it really leads to is a lot of U.S. tire jobs going to China.
So that Cooper moved to China?
So Cooper sent workers from Albany to train workers in China.
We're hearing this story more and more. The Times had a story recently about how Disney was bringing people into the United States and having their workers train these new immigrants to take their jobs at a lower salary.
And then they proceeded to set off a bidding war amongst their four or five U.S. factories to see who could give up the most concessions and stay open, because one of the plants had to close while they moved to China. Cooper wasn't, or the Albany plant was not unionized. They could not make any concessions, and they closed. And after 25 years of working there, when I last spoke to Chuck, he had started work as a migrant farmer in his 60s with no security. He had cashed in his pension in order to keep his home out of foreclosure. And Cooper had record profits in 2013.
He says he's depressed, but he keeps on taking classes and sending out resumes. But let's back up a bit. When Cooper moved there, they must have gotten special concessions from the state. Usually that's what happens. You get tax breaks and the like. There was no guarantee built into that they would stay beyond 25 years?
There wasn't that I know of. I certainly went during the debate to see where which of Cooper's plants would close, states. The states where they were housed got into a frenzy as well, trying to give tax breaks and concessions to keep them. The Mississippi plant, for instance, stayed. They gave them a nice package to keep them there. I don't remember the details of the package itself. Georgia did come to the plate, but not enough. But the big dividing line seems to be, now Cooper never released the details of their audit on the choice, but the big dividing line seems to be that the non-unionized plant was unable to give enough concessions to keep their jobs.
In 2013, annual profits for Cooper were $241 million, and its CEO, Roy Arms, who joined Cooper in 2007, made $9 million last year. This is a brand that we're seeing all across the country.
Yeah, and that's...
And it's an American brand, theoretically.
Well, they merged with an Indian tire maker in 2013, and that's part of what drove drove the record profits. But I think the lesson there is that you have someone like Chuck that goes from, again, a 25-year stable job with benefits and security to someone who is now a migrant worker in his 60s, while you have a handful of people at Cooper making millions of dollars by sending jobs overseas. And I think that's the transition that we have seen in a place like Albany.
And we're seeing more and more in this country. We'll get to that in a moment. My guest is Kai Wright, a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. His article in the August issue of Harper's is "What Recovery? 2 Years in a Town Where the Great Recession Never Ended." This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Lenny Lopate. You moved to Albany, Georgia, just to report the story?
No. I did not move down to Albany, Georgia. It felt like it. I went back and forth reporting on it for a couple of years. And I've done a great deal of reporting in Georgia as it is. I have sadly had reason to go down there repeatedly in reporting on poverty since just before the recession began. So I was familiar with South Georgia and that it was going to be a place where we could sadly tell a lot of stories like this.
And in telling Chuck Jenkins' story, you also wove in a history of segregation in Albany, Georgia. Has there been any improvement in race relations over the years?
There's been quite a worsening, actually, since the recession began. It's funny, Albany also holds a unique place in civil rights history. It's the place that is widely believed where King lost, where Martin Luther King lost. To the Albany movement was sort of considered the nadir of the Southern civil rights movement because he was outflanked by the local law enforcement. They weren't able to get the kind of provoke the kind of reaction that they got from a Bull Connor with the local law enforcement. And he left largely in defeat and shame. And that is a unique part of the history there. Following him, the local organizers, including people like Shirley and Charles Sherrod, you'll remember Shirley Sherrod from the early days of the Obama administration. Her husband, Charles Sherrod, was one of the founding members of SNCC. And they ended up being the civil rights movement there for generations, again, trying to improve things. When I got there in early 2012, late 2011, I was struck by how bad things had devolved in terms of race relations because of the economy. And the real dividing line is about white flight and folks who feel like white folks are moving across the county line and taking all their capital with them.
And the reason for that is that they can afford to move.
Sure. Because of the wealth divide that exists in the nation widely. When bad times come, white families tend to have more options than black families.
Albany's poverty rate has jumped by 12 points between 2007 and 2010 alone. And you write that although the overall unemployment rate is 39.9% among the town's African-American residents, who account for two-thirds of the town's residents, it's almost 42%.
That's correct. One of there are several things about poverty today that are striking, and one of them is how deeply racialized it is. So Albany's numbers are a microcosm. There's 27% of African Americans in the country live in poverty today. There are 13 states where the black poverty rate is at or above 30%. There is one state, Kentucky, where the white poverty rate is above 15%.
What was the unemployment rate in Albany before the Great Recession?
I'm not going to recall the number off the top of my head, but I think there was this dramatic spike in it that led to this dramatic spike in poverty, and the poverty went up 13% in that time period. I can tell you that off the top of my head.
And you in your research, you found that employers are behaving differently this time in their hiring practices.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that economists talk about, is that that employees have gone from being long-term investments to short-term costs. And so when one of the things that folks notice is that during the recession, productivity went up, meaning that employers were laying off more people than they had to lay off. And it used to be that employers were reluctant to do layoffs in bad times because the costs of rehiring and retraining a place like Bob's Candies, which did in fact go through some tough times, kept someone like Major Jones on. They did some layoffs, but they kept as many of the longtime employees as they could because they saw them as assets. That's no longer true for a host of reasons. And we see that in a number of ways. We saw it in the debate we had during the 2012 presidential elections about creative destruction, is the term that private equity uses in terms of having to tear things down in order to rebuild them up. We see that in the disruptiveness of the tech economy today, which is really just about getting rid of jobs altogether, getting rid of the cost of workers altogether. And so there have been a number of macro trends that lead to employees having much less security from year to year.
And we keep on hearing, even in the case of Verizon workers right here in the city, of very successful companies asking for all sorts of givebacks from their workers. That's just part of the way contracts are being negotiated these days. But you say there aren't many unions.
Well,
a town like Albany.
Well, no, I mean, Albany is, and I should have to say that
that's a right to Georgia's a right to
absolutely,
work state.
Absolutely, it's an original right to work state before we even had the concept. And I should say that I talked to very few people, including Chuck, and including people who have laid off who are pro-union. People believe that unions were bad. So way back in the early 80s, Firestone closed. And that in Albany, and that was a big blow at the time. And
is that why Cooper came in, because they were already experienced tire workers?
Well, there was a big gap in time there. I mean, Cooper came in. Cooper was lured in, as you mentioned earlier. But when Firestone closed, the conventional wisdom became it was because of unions. And that was the talking point that was developing nationally at that time. And it really became embedded in the culture there.
You're right that Albany looks like almost any mid-sized city in America. But if, quote, you scratch the surface of even the relatively well-off areas, you begin to see how a town in which 4 out of 10 people are poor can collapse in on itself.
Yeah. And it's striking because you see folks. So there's the 40% who are living in poverty. Right. And amongst those, a huge percentage of who are living in deep poverty, right, that are less than half of the official poverty rate, which is another thing that's relevant about today's poverty. But then I would meet folks, small business owners who have all of the education necessary and have just enough resources. They could actually leave Albany, but have chosen to stay for a variety of reasons. And they are just ahead of it. They are just ahead of the wave. I met a man who he had a very successful drapery business for years. Him and his wife ran
Floyd Falk.
When I met him, he had kept it open because closing it would have meant going into bankruptcy. So he kept it open just enough to stay ahead of that wave. But spent all of his time working installing dish satellites in order to pay his income. Now he's in his late 50s.
He's climbing on rooftops now.
Yeah, this is somebody who had already built a successful life and a successful business. And so people like that who are just staying ahead of it, I think it is also something that's indicative of our economy. There are a number of studies showing how many Americans are living below 250% of the federal poverty level, which means they're one paycheck away from a disaster.
A listener on Twitter points out that Georgia didn't expand Medicaid or establish a health care exchange. Are there many health problems there?
Well, this is striking. I've also been doing a lot of reporting on the impact of Medicaid expansion, and it really is. I think it's what's notable is that this is the Affordable Care Act, for all the other things that have been said about it, is the largest poverty program we've seen since Medicaid, since the Great Society. And one of the knock-on effects of the states that have failed to participate is the pressure that it is putting on the healthcare economy in those states. So there's what happens to the patients, but there's also what happens to the healthcare economy. So in a place like Albany, for instance, one of the few bright spots is the hospital there, the healthcare system there. And it's controversial for a whole host of reasons, but it does employ a lot of folks. They, when I last looked, were starting to discuss layoffs because Georgia has not participated in Medicaid. As a consequence, the hospitals are not getting the revenue influx that they were expecting to get, and that system is now being stressed financially.
My guest is Kai Wright, K-A-I. He is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and we're discussing his article in the August issue of Harper's, What Recovery? 2 years in a town where the Great Recession never ended. We'll continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Kai Wright, a contributing writer at Harper's Magazine, who is also is at the Nation Institute. As a reporting fellow of the investigative fund of the Nation Institute. His article in Harper's, What Recovery? 2 years in a town where the Great Recession never ended, is what we are discussing right now. You mentioned Floyd Falk, who is a white 52-year-old lifelong resident of Albany, Georgia. There's also another person you write about is Lanisha Hart, a young black entrepreneur who has her own sportswear shop. Is this problem in Albany affecting the local shops?
Yeah, I mean, it's really striking. If you go to, you know, Albany is one of these towns that has a historic downtown, and it's quite beautiful, and there's a lovely park off that they've developed off of the edge of downtown with Spanish moss on the trees and a 100-year-old bridge, and it's really quite bucolic and until you look at all of the shops that are closed up, and all of the businesses that stand boarded up. Lanisha is a great example of what happens in a place like that. So she's, as you said, a young black woman who kind of really represents all of the stuff that we were supposed to be excited about with the Obama era. She's well-educated. She's an entrepreneur. She could have gone anywhere. She moved back home and started a business to become a leader in her community. And she stays there. She does. But her business, when I went by, she had this front door locked because she has this beautiful storefront, but all of her business is mail order. There's nobody from Albany that can buy anything. And so she's just lucky enough to have a national customer base. And so she's in the back of the store filling mail orders. You know,
she close the shop and then save herself some money?
She could, but she's somebody who's invested. And I think this was the positive side of this story that I hope that we can find a way to tap into here and nationally, is that she's deeply invested in her community. And I met so many people like that who are just so deeply invested. Her family is there. She's from there. And rather than leaving, she's trying to make an impact on the place, but she's going to need help.
What impact has this had on the local schools? I know you spoke to some teachers. White flight in the past have led to even more segregation at the point when segregation is supposed to no longer be legal. Is it exacerbating the situation in Albany?
It is. I spoke with a couple of teachers who had been there for a very long time. One of which, it was interesting, I was sitting in one of the classrooms, and she went to school in the same school, and one of her teachers is now her colleague, and so we sat and we were able to talk about what things have looked like over the generations. And as I said, Albany has always been a place that struggled with poverty. And so as a consequence, the school system has always struggled with the effects of poverty, but they've been able to struggle with it. They've been able to fight it and find ways to overcome it. And to hear these two hardworking women talk, they sounded like they had just reached rope's end, and they just list the litany of things that suddenly went on steroids when these plants started closing, because everyone who had any investment left. People who had the resources to really come and be part of the school and really help the teachers left. And so the students and the families they left with were people who were living through daily trauma of poverty, which makes their job almost impossible.
You say the only industry you found in Albany that's growing is religion.
Yeah. It's and there's some cynicism in town about that, but the proliferating numbers of storefront churches that are blossoming everywhere. But, you know, again, I have to say, I entered with that cynicism as well. And I'm somebody who grew up in the church, but I entered with that cynicism. And having spent the time there, and particularly with Major Jones and his very small congregation, him and his wife founded, I was really struck by, again, the role that they're playing in keeping people present and keeping people looking towards some kind of positive future.
Well, also feeding people. Spoke with Juanita Nixon, who works for her church's Family Resource Center. They have a food bank.
Yeah. And it's sad. I was at there's a large food bank distribution center on the edge of town, and it's where I met Juanita, and we were there, and talking to some of the folks who were coming in to pick up their supplies for their centers, and I asked Juanita, so you know, what do you need most, what could be most helpful, and it sounds ridiculous, but her response was, well, I need hope. We need hope here is what we really need.
A lot of people told you that.
Yeah. It's really quite striking. And I think that's what was moving to me about being in Major Jones's church and talking to people like Lenicia is the folks that are able to find hope. And what is then enraging about our public policy response, and that they're not getting the support they need.
I'm talking with Kai Wright, contributing writer to Harper's Magazine. His article, What Recovery? 2 Years in a Town Where the Great Recession Never Ended, is in the August issue of the magazine. But you write that Albany is a more extreme example of something that's happening all across the country, namely that a greater share of Americans are poor today than at any time since the 1960s. What is the official definition of poor?
So it's a complicated definition, but the federal poverty level, they set it at, for instance, in 2013, I believe, for a family of four, it was $25,000. So that's the official poverty level. 45 million people live below that.
Wouldn't poverty vary from place to place? I'd imagine that that amount of money in Albany would go a little further than it might even in another part of Georgia.
That is true. And, you know, let
alone New York City.
let alone New York City. And that is true. You know, we have a federal poverty guideline and we use that shorthand. It's honestly quite a complicated formula. So we use this, the federal government uses this shorthand to say this is the cutoff mark, right? And so that's at about $25,000 for a family. And it changes depending on the size of the composition of the family. But what's important is to look at that number relative to history, right? And so if you subtract working age, if you just look at working age Americans, so you subtract people who are receiving Social Security, which is another extremely successful poverty program, we have a higher number. We have a higher poverty rate today than we have had since the beginning of the war on poverty.
In 2013, the U.S. recorded 45.3 million people who lived below the official poverty line, one-third with children. Is it harder today to get out of poverty?
Well, this is what's striking, is that it's easier to get into poverty, and it's never been easy to get out of poverty, right? So one of the real fundamentals of economics and why we work so hard to prevent the poverty rate from going up in the first instance is the rate of escape from poverty is dismal.
So we have 14.7 million children living in poverty. It's likely that most of them will go on to lives of poverty.
They are statistically likely to live as adults as poverty without a massive intervention to correct it of the size that we have only seen a couple of times in our country. And that's what's striking. And what is also striking is how many people live so close to that line. I mentioned this earlier, but there are, I believe the number is half, if you count the people who are in poverty and up to under 250% of poverty, I believe half of Americans, according to one Brookings Institute study, live below 250% of poverty. That means half of Americans were either destitute or one paycheck away from it.
And then you write
that is striking.
You write that 20 million people live in what economists call deep poverty. That's less than half the official poverty line. 20 million people is three times the number of people who lived in deep poverty in 1976.
Yeah.
So this is a trend for the whole country.
That's right. And if you, and again, getting back to what I was saying at the beginning of our discussion, is that if you graph the income inequality alongside the deep poverty rate, you see similarly sharp spikes. And I think that's what we really need to understand, is that that the conversation we have when we talk about income and wealth concentration is not just about, oh, some people got really wealthy. The point is that in order for that to happen, the corollary to that is 20 million people have to live at half the poverty line. And that we are at a place, we are essentially statistically back to where we were at the beginning of the great society and the war on poverty today.
How much of this is a result of companies leaving the country, and how much of this is a result of other factors, just political ideas? Because our politics have changed a lot since 1976, when there were concerns about poverty in America.
I mean, our politics have changed such that we've allowed a change in the equation between owners, between capital and labor. So that's one of the things. We've allowed a change in the equation between people, between workers and people who hire them. And that has led to enormous insecurity for workers, which then leads to poverty. We have entered into a series of trade deals, and one that we are now debating a new one. We have entered into a series of trade deals that have encouraged people who would create jobs in the United States to instead take those jobs elsewhere. And so there have been a series of decisions like these over the last 30 years that have led to this moment. And alongside that, we have decided to stop investing in poverty alleviation. Right, we have remade the welfare system. We have made it much more difficult for people to get things like food stamps. We have made it much more difficult for we have discussed making unemployment more difficult. Unemployment insurance more difficult. Thankfully, we have not achieved that nationally. So we have made we have both encouraged lack of security for workers, and we have removed the supports for workers when the bottom falls out.
And you write, I'm quoting, "Recessions always create a trailing effect in which joblessness and poverty extend past the worst part of a downturn. But the most recent recession has had a tail like no other. As of May 2015, nearly 30% of the nation's unemployed has been out of work for at least 5 months." Or 6 months.
6 months, yeah. And this is a number we do hear a lot about, thankfully, and that there are so many people who are just out of the workforce at this point. Our workforce continues to shrink. People who have just – who don't even show up in the unemployment numbers.
So what do they do to survive?
All kinds of stuff. Some of them barely do. Many of them hustle. Some do things like Chuck, right? So Chuck got informal labor. His temporary – his job – farming peanuts was not on the books. And there's a lot of folks like that here in New York and across the country who are either in the informal economy or who are just in destitute poverty.
Are you suggesting that what we're seeing in Albany, Georgia is what we're going to be seeing all around the country?
It's what we are seeing all around the country. It's what we are seeing all around the country. Again, when you look at those macro numbers, this is something that's happening everywhere. And keeping in mind, again, a place like Albany, this was the cornerstone for a regional economy we're talking about. It's not just that city.
Which part of Georgia is it?
So this is southeast Georgia. southwest Georgia. And so in southwest Georgia, when a city like Albany collapses, everything around it starts to collapse as well. I was in a small town in Baker County outside of Albany with Shirley Sherrod talking about what are the options for a place like this. It's where she actually grew up, where she's still there trying to do some work, trying to teach people new farming techniques where they might be able to do something in the future. And so what's an option for a place like this? Where's the future? And one of its greatest champions and people working, someone who's working full time trying to save it said, I don't know that there's a future for this place.
State legislators from the area, they are not suggesting any Any things that might improve the situation?
I think what we're at is we're well past state level solutions, I think, is the uptake here.
Well, if the state doesn't want to take things from the federal government because of political ideology, then where does that lead these people?
Well, one thing that we did see work at the beginning of the Obama era was the first stimulus, and much has been said about it not being large enough, and I think what we see in Albany is proof of that. However, we did see the impact of a massive public national investment in recreating communities, and I think that is really the hope for a place like Albany.
What recovery? 2 years in a town where the Great Recession never ended is Kai Wright's article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine, where he is a contributing writer. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you very much for having me.